Is anybody on?
All right.
So you got a good.
Floor is yours, Mr. Pulaski.
Thank you. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Mike Pulaski. I'm the Oil and Gas Program Manager for the Department of Revenue. I appreciate the invite to come up and speak to the Interior Delegation. What I'm going to do is go through a presentation that I've been giving to various groups around the state that has been modified to reflect the recent release of new information in the Revenue Sources Book, the Fall 2013, and there's a link at the end of the presentation where people can find that online. My goals are really three things, and first is to give you a feeling for what the legislature and the administration were looking at in the decision to undertake oil tax reform. Second, what the issues in the tax system that were identified by the legislative and administrative consultants over a period of years were. Then finally, what the legislature did, and then how the revenue source book changes and assumptions change some of the issues and effects that we were looking at during the legislative session. So briefly, I'll start off with this slide. This has been referred to as the spaghetti chart. And what it is it's comparing production in Alaska with comparable jurisdictions around North America. In the blue, what you see is production in the Alaska North Slope from 1977 to just past 2011. The yellow is Texas. The dark brown is Alberta, and the bright red is North Dakota. The dotted line is the oil price, that's in green. And what you can see is that from really the peak in the late 1980s through about 1995, 1996, Alaska and Texas were declining on a relatively close scale. As prices started to rise in the early 2000s, you saw production flatten out and turn around in a lot of jurisdictions around the country, including Alaska. I like to remind people of the old no decline after 99 that lasted really through mid-2005. There were a lot of projects, both satellite fields, gas cap water injection, and other work that was done on the North Slope during that time period. Since the mid-2000s, despite higher and higher oil prices, Alaska's seen a decline in production. What I don't like about that chart, though, is that the discussion around the need for oil tax reform and production in Alaska focused too much on places like North Dakota and Texas. The reality is the boom in production that we're seeing in the lower 48 is across the board. States like Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, we're looking towards Ohio becoming a major oil producer. Colorado, New Mexico. New technology, new innovation, and high oil prices are driving development across the United States. What I've done in these charts is from 2007 to 2008, what they're measuring is the rate of change in oil production year over year in each of those states, starting from Oklahoma, going all the way over to New Mexico. What I've also done in the upper right-hand corner is put the Alaska North Slope oil price compared to the West Texas Intermediate price. It's an important distinction because, as you can see, in 2007, 2008, they traded fairly close to each other in Alaska oil traded at a slight discount to West Texas Intermediate. But when the public reads about oil prices, often they're reading the West Texas Intermediate price. Many of you have perhaps noticed there's not a daily posting of the Alaska North Slope oil price anymore. What happens is you get it a day after. And that's partly because the amount of oil being produced in Alaska has declined to the point where there isn't a publicly available tracking system anymore. The Department of Revenue works through Platts, and that's not a publicly available number until the day after. So where we used to watch the news, we don't get to see the daily oil price until the day after. But looking at ANS and WTI, 2007 to 2008, you saw some states in the United States increasing production, some were still declining, and our prices were trading in a relatively narrow window. 2008, 2009, people remember the global recession, the collapse of the financial markets, Lehman Brothers. You see the oil price drop to the low 60s and production decline across the board. There are still some areas that are increasing, but compared to 2007, 2008, it's a significant year-on-year decline. That's to be expected with a major implosion in the global marketplace. 2009-2010, oil prices start to turn around, going up to roughly $80 a barrel. Again, ANS is trading at a discount to WTI. But as prices are rising, you see some of those declines start to turn around. 2010-2011, this is when the state of Alaska started to look at undertaking oil tax reform. What we saw here that concerned both, I think, the legislature and the administration was the diversion of ANS versus WTI. Alaska North Slope crude started to trade at a premium to what oil in the lower 48 was trading at. The average during this time period was a $15 a barrel premium. Our oil was more valuable than oil produced in the lower 48. At the same time, you saw, again, those declines in other states start to turn around. Alaska continued on a 6.5% decline. What I think was really interesting about this time period is with that premium, and remember, the state of Alaska has a relatively empty pipeline. If a company finds and develops oil on the North Slope, there wasn't a transportation constraint to move that oil to market. That oil could move through the pipeline, get in the tankers, get to market, trade for a $15 a barrel premium. But we saw the continued production decline. 2011-2012, the same $15 premium. But what you notice is that Alaska, at that stage, was the only state of the major oil-producing states that continued a production decline, down 6.6%, while California had turned it around 0.8%. Again, with the same $15 a barrel premium. So while we were seeing a continued decline on the production side, the state of Alaska also looked at the investment side. What was going on upstream in our fields? This chart got a lot of use during the legislative session, and there's a lot of information on it. So taking a moment to describe what's happening here, what it's examining is comparing upstream capital spending for oil and gas in development, in exploration and production in the Alaska North Slope, the United States, and worldwide. Now remember, because worldwide spending is huge in comparison to the state of Alaska, what you have to do is use a methodology called benchmarking to make them equal. So what the chart is doing is not measuring the absolute level of investment. What it's doing is saying, in 2003, if we make all of them equal at 100, what we can do is measure the rate of change over time between those areas. So in the blue, you have the Alaska North Slope. In the green, you have the United States. And in the red, you have worldwide capital spending in exploration and development. The black is the change in oil price. What we saw when we looked at this chart was the move from 2003 to roughly 2006. As oil prices started that steady rise, you saw a comparable increase in growth in spending upstream on the North Slope as you saw worldwide and in the United States. 2007, that starts to diverge. You see the other regions, the United States and worldwide, continue to grow while Alaska starts to level off. You see the oil price spike up into 2008. That divergence gets markedly higher than it was in 2007. 2008-2009, again, global financial recession, everywhere around the world drops. But with the oil price rise from 2009-2010-2011-2012, you see the divergence really materialize between Alaska, the United States, and worldwide upstream spending. So on the one hand, in the previous charts, we saw declining production. What we see in these charts is, despite the higher prices, flat investment. And so when the governor and the legislature started to look at oil tax reform, it was in the context of these two problems. These were the problems the state of Alaska was looking at. Despite high prices, we had declining production. Despite high prices, we had relatively flat investment compared to the boom in production turnarounds that were going on all over the country and the world.
Mike, before you go yes. from that one, what has baffled me, the previous slides mm-hmm. showed that all the other domestic production areas mm-hmm. have increased
yes.
their production. We have half the spending, it appears, of the other provinces, and yet we have continued decline in production.
It's an important thing to remember in this chart. What the chart is not showing you is our level of investment. What the chart is showing is just the rate of change in the investment. And so what you're seeing here is Alaska's staying relatively flat. So we are 125% what we were in 2003.
Well, they're 450%.
I'm sorry, 225. So what you've seen is a rapid change in other places. That change correlates with the growth in production because investment and production are linked. We talked a lot about that around capital credits in the last session.
So they're still saying that even though we have increased over 2003 our capital spending and we're still having a decline in our production. So
absolutely.
It's still saying it's more expensive on the slope, or what is it saying?
What it's saying is it's more expensive on the slope on a per barrel basis, that as less and less oil is produced, but it's also really telling us that despite the high prices, the growth in investment on the North Slope is not something we've seen that you would have expected to see with prices rising. Just as we saw from 2003 to 2006 as prices went up, investment in the North Slope had a steady growth in that upstream investment, change year over year. You get to 2008, 2009, and it kind of flatlines. Now, as we look at revising these things, there is a major bump in 2013 that correlates with the settlement of things like Point Thompson and the permitting changes to allow the development of CD5. But those are, I think Point Thompson itself is a separate issue that was a litigation settlement. This is looking at what the administration in particular was focusing on were the general problems we were trying to solve the state was confronted with. Flat investment in the North Slope and declining production compared to the booms we were seeing everywhere else.
But a benchmarking is only one way of doing a chart like that.
Absolutely.
Right. It's just showing capital.
It's just showing capital for exploration and development.
It doesn't show the difference between profits and reinvestment.
Absolutely not.
Right.
No, this is particular just for upstream investment.
Yeah.
So both over several years, really a period of 3 years, the administration and the legislature all brought consultants to the table. Those consultants said, looking at the environment, looking at the problems that you're dealing with, declining production, flat, spending and investment, they identified, this was the legislature's consultants, PFC Energy. This is a slide that was delivered in February of 2013, I believe, to the Senate Resources Committee, so many of you will be familiar with this. They said there are really five key problems with ACES, with the old tax system. First, high levels of government take reduce competitiveness for capital, especially at high prices. Second, the high marginal tax rate reduces incentives for spending control. Third, the complexity makes meaningful economic analysis and comparison difficult. Fourth, there's significant state exposure in low-price environments and for high-cost developments. And fifth, the impact of large gas sales on tax rates. When we looked at these five problems, you can really boil them down to the interaction of two things within the old tax system. One is the mathematical function that was progressivity. The other were the capital credits that the state offered linked specifically to capital spending. So in the next charts, I'm going to talk a little bit about why that is, why each one of these is a combination of the two.
Yeah, but I want to, you know, I mean, I've been sitting for years listening to all this stuff. Those could be problems with ACES, but they're not problems with reinvestment. Problems with reinvestment are a whole different level of things. I mean, you know, they tell us, whether it's Pedro or Johnson or whoever it is, that what they want is a consistent level of taxes. They don't want an irregular tax structure. They want to be able to plan long term.
Absolutely.
You know, and then the high government take is a factor, but they're competing against projects worldwide that has more to do with what they want to do either geopolitically or somebody has a better project or, you know, so when we're looking at ACES, you know, and Senate Bill 21 and all those things, that's not the whole world. It's just the world on our taxes here.
Absolutely.
Because we're looking at reinvestment in Alaska, there's larger issues that we have no control over.
There are issues we don't have control over, and then there are issues that we do. And I can be sure to send you or point out within the Department of Revenue, we have a document log that includes all the presentations by the administration's consultants At the same time, the legislative budget and audit website has links to presentations that your consultants on the legislative branch made. Within those are detailed economic comparisons on a range of factors, internal rate of return, net present value, cash margin per barrel, that the committees and staff work through in comparing the tax systems and revisions across the committee standing at a global level, looking at how they compare to different investment opportunities around the world. What I'm attempting to do here is take that back up to the macro level and reflect what the legislative consultants describe were the problems. These are very similar to what Pedro described. If you go back to his, I believe it was 2011, 2012 presentations to the Senate Finance Committee, he identified these same problems. And your point on predictability is a really important one. Remember, progressivity itself, under ACES you had a flat tax of 25% that then changed based on what the progressive tax rate was. So a company's tax rate was actually 25% plus the progressivity factor. The progressivity factor itself depended on the level of throughput, the price in the market, the amount of company spending, and ultimately the TAPS tariff. All three of those, four of those variables interact with each other and creates a very volatile tax system. Remember, under ACES,
Could you repeat those four?
Yeah, the four factors are the price of oil, the level of production, the amount of company spending, and ultimately the TAPS tariff. All four of those factors derive what your tax rate is. What this chart is showing you is simplified data from the RSB from fiscal year 2009, going from July to June. Remember, progressivity was calculated on a monthly basis. What that means is a company's tax rates changed on a monthly basis. And your point about planning is critical. Because if I'm looking at an investment, remember, one of the greatest incentives in the tax system to investment is the ability to deduct capital and operating expenses. The ability to deduct those depends on my tax rate. If my tax rate depends on the price of oil, the level of production, the amount I'm spending, and the TAPS tariff, those are variables I can't predict on a long-term basis. So what this very complicated chart is showing you is the variability month by month. And I'd ask you not to focus on the effective tax rate, which is the tax after credits, but actually look at the progressive tax rate. In July, it was 26.6%. On top of the base tax rate of 25, that changed by December to no progressivity because, as you see, prices went from 132.87 to 37.70. By June, it had risen back up to 4.8%. So what's happening under ACE is one of the biggest problems when the consultants talked about complexity makes meaningful economic analysis and comparison difficult. Having a tax rate that changes on a monthly basis, depending on four factors, three of which, the oil price, the level of production, and the TAPS tariff, you really have no control over. The ability to make long-term decisions and predictions is almost impossible.
So when Pioneer was testifying in front of Senate Resources, you know, they've been here not quite 10 years, and he says, this will be the fourth time you guys have changed taxes on me, and I've spent over $1.5 billion.
That's right.
You know, how am I supposed to do business here?
It's an issue.
You know, he's got to deal with the referendum. could you go back to that last sentence you just said? When the three of which you have no control were...
Really, the oil price?
Price,
the level of production, and the TAPS tariff.
Yeah. Well, but the TAPS tariff is controlled by the majors, the producers.
It's actually not. I mean, the TAPS tariff is...
Yeah, it is. It is. There's been court cases dealing with that time after time.
And that's what I'd say is the TAPS tariff is determined ultimately by court cases.
Yeah, right, to reveal what's going on. But they control, to a certain extent, what the tariff is for themselves.
They do, in terms of what they submit to FERC, or the RCA, what FERC and the RCA, after litigation, come back with and decide, changes that. Just as court cases around property tax is a recoverable number in the tax tariff. They don't control the property taxes.
No,
as those change,
they do. I mean, that's the part that goes to court.
Absolutely.
But the tariffs as a whole, or they're taxing them, they're charging themselves what they want to tax to be one way or another. That's one of the hindrances of markets to other players besides production facilities on the North Slope.
Tax is a hindrance to other
players.
I'm
saying is that it's a lot more complicated than a spreadsheet saying that these numbers are outside of everything like that and they don't have control over them. Between the tariff and the capacity of production on the North Slope, those are things that they do control. The facilities are full. In order to increase production from an independent coming in, they either have to build their own processing facility or expand or have one of the majors expand their own. That's...
Depends on the circumstances.
Well,
it depends
course.
On where you are.
It depends on distance from the line.
But it also, I mean, think about the issue of progressivity. When a company fundamentally produces more revenue over less barrels, that increases their production tax value, which increases their tax rate. If you think about the issue in a facility sharing agreement where a company comes in and backs out another company's production, the company, the independent coming in, pays the incumbent producer to use that facility, and they have to back out the oil that the other producer is making room for. That payment increases the production tax value of the producer who's letting the new entrant in. Then the new entrant has to compensate the incumbent producer for the increase in their tax rate on all their other barrels that the progressivity equation created. That's part of the complexity that the consultants were looking at, is what impact this variable tax rate and the unintended consequences of it are to things like new players, to things like the TAPS tariff and the ability to plan.
But that's the point. The pipeline's at a quarter capacity, but the facilities up north are at max. Okay, that's all right.
I just want to dovetail on what David said, but the prize for us should be, and it's not even an argument. I mean, I agree with the facility sharing agreement and how that works. And if you talk to some of the independents, knowing what they know now, they'd have built their own processing facility.
Absolutely.
But be that as it may, the bottom line is, to me, the more production you get going through the pipe is going to be a higher net back to the state of Alaska.
And a lower tariff for all the new entrants.
Absolutely.
Because it's ultimately the cost. That's what I mean, is that you don't control the cost of, you don't control the tariff because that's adjudicated and regulated by other people. And frankly, the Department of Revenue uses reasonable transportation costs. We had this fight in the House Resources Committee last session. Representative Kawasaki remembers this. I think it was 1:30 or 2 a.m. in the morning about reasonable transportation costs. That's where the Department of Revenue does not use the tariffs in calculation of production tax. We have a separate formula where the state, when it is a party selling to themselves in a non-arm's length transaction, uses a formula that the Department of Revenue developed through regulations to protect the state. The point, going back to what the administration legislative consultants identified, was that complexity. Now remember, the deductibility of capital spending, the benefit a company gets for that deductibility depends on your tax rate. We walked through this in the progressivity presentations that are posted online. What happens to benefit a company when they write their capital expenditures off under progressivity at a higher or lower price changes the value to that company. Again, because of those variables that you don't control, price, TAPS tariff, level of production, overall on the slope, you don't know what the benefit of capital deductions are. You can't plan in the long term when you have a monthly tax rate that changes. At the same time, to offset that high and variable tax rate, the state of Alaska provided credits based on what a company's capital spending in the state of Alaska was. When the legislature looked at this credit exposure, we had seen it building from 2009, 10, 11, 12, and forecast for 13 and 14 to a significant number. We were looking at over $1 billion in credits next year based solely on what a company's capital investment was. That was particularly troubling going back to the analysis of what happens as prices drop? What happens for high-cost developments? And frankly, one of the things that concerned the Department of Revenue most is what happens in the event of no-fault shutdowns. If there's an interruption in taps and spending is still happening on the North Slope and your credits are linked to spending, not production, what you have is a situation where the state does not have the revenue but still has the credit obligation. When the state of Alaska and the legislature and the governor looked at this connection of credits based on capital spending, the risk to the state through the declining taps production and what would happen in the events of shutdowns really created a connection that was unstable for the state. That's what the legislative consultants identified as significant state exposure and the incentives for spending. So we have the combination of a high and variable tax rate that changed on a monthly basis and credits linked directly to capital spending. Now, I point out the chart is showing you two different types of credits. The red are credits applied against a production tax liability. Those are credits earned by a company that has a tax obligation. They use those credits to directly reduce their taxes. The blue is credits that are refunded to a company that does not have a tax obligation. So what we saw is a growth between those two. In the revenue source book, you will see a continued existence of the credits refunded to companies without a tax obligation. Remember, the changes in SB 21, which we'll get to next, only applied to investment north of 68. The capital credits and a lot of the credits still exist south of 68, which is in the area we all call Middle Earth, and in the Cook Inlet Basin. So when you see in the budget and the revenue source book tax liabilities, it's specifically for that.
Be a Hobbit legislator.
So Mike, so for example, in 2011, that $450
million
in blue.
Yes.
How much of that?
I don't know the exact answer to that.
Most of it?
450 in 2011?
Or, I mean, going forward, how much is that going to come down if we eliminate, if we're just talking about eliminating north of 68?
Well, you eliminated north of 68 on the capital credit. Remember, we retained the loss carry forward, which is targeted specifically to new companies that are in that investment stage, that are spending more than they're collecting. That was done in the Senate Finance Committee and then made monetizable in the House Finance Committee to protect those new investors. So we see some going forward on the North Slope. I'm just letting you know that when you look at the RSB in the back, for the first time, I believe we actually break out in detail non-North Slope lease expenditures. That will allow you to be able to look at where the relative numbers are coming from. I try and be very careful, remember, talking about taxpayer specifics.
So when you say tax credits, that includes the carry-forward?
Absolutely. It's the carry-forward, the capital, and the exploration credits, which we frankly haven't seen used all that much. But the majority of it is the 20% capital credit. Again, credits linked to spending and a high and variable tax rate were the two fundamental problems. So what did the More Alaska Production Act do? Fundamentally, it attacked those two problems in very direct ways. First, we eliminated the progressive portion of the tax. Then we increased the tax rate from 25 to 35%. And then changed the credits from ones based on purely capital spending with the elimination of the qualified capital expenditure credit north of 68 degrees to ones based on production. There are two types of production that the state identifies, and I think it's really important to differentiate between new oil and gross value reduction eligible oil. They're actually two different things. For the vast majority of oil, what we'd all call legacy production, that oil coming out of the existing units, that credit was $0 to $8 per barrel. Remember, before it was based on 20% of the capital spending of a company. Now it's on a per barrel basis. That $8 to $0 is actually reversed. At low prices, the credit is higher. As the price of oil rises, the credit reduces to zero. That's how SB 21 built a slightly progressive nature into the tax system. As the price goes up and the credit is less necessary because prices have gone up, it goes to zero. For the gross value reduction eligible oil, that stayed at the $5 per barrel, but there's an additional incentive that is a reduction based on the gross value of the oil produced. So again, both of those are linked directly to production. You have a credit per barrel that depends on what the production is, and you have a reduction for eligible new oil that's based on the gross value of that new production. The three criteria for the gross value reduction are that it's from a unit that was formed after January 1, 2003, that it's from new participating areas in a unit that was formed before 2003. Remember, a participating area is a distinct geologic area of oil. It's a new bubble of oil within the unit that hasn't been developed or approved by DNR prior to these dates. Second, the expansion of a participating area. That's when you take the existing geologic formation and actually add acreage to it. What qualifies is only the area of that acreage, and it only qualifies if you meet two criteria. First, the expansion occurred and DNR approved the expansion. Second, the company can demonstrate to the Department of Revenue that it can measure the production coming from that area. That is what the Department of Revenue just released regulations specifically targeted towards.
Mike?
Yes?
Could you run through that paragraph again and just say it over again so you don't have to explain it differently or right? Just say it.
Sure. There are three eligibility requirements for gross value reduction. First, units formed after January 1, 2003, those are new units. Second, new participating areas in existing units. Those are new and distinct geologic bubbles of oil within the old units that aren't developed, aren't identified, that DNR has to approve. Third, an expansion, an addition of acreage to the existing participating areas in the units. That's when actual acreage is added. And that third category is only qualified if two criteria are met. One, the expansion is approved by DNR and occurs. Second, the company can demonstrate to the Department of Revenue that it can measure the production from that new area.
Metering
is what the regulations say. You have to meter the production, and the entire producing interval actually has to be in the new acreage. You cannot have a producing interval, that section of the well that is actually drawing the oil out, that is in any way connected to the old acreage. It actually has to all be in the new acreage, and it all has to come through meter. Now, we don't require metering on each individual well. We allow a company to aggregate and run it through multi-phase meters that are a strict requirement. But we looked at that and said it is the most transparent and predictable way is to go through metering.
So,
yes.
In recent history, has there ever been a new unit formed, a new participating area, or a new expansion? Or is the department currently in deliberations on whether there are any of those three happening today?
Since this time period? Has there been a new unit formed since ACES on the North Slope?
Basically, Alpine, Capara, Prudhoe Bay.
All before 2003.
Right.
Absolutely. The ones after January 1, 2003 that I know about are Ugarit, Nikaichuk, and I believe Mustang Beachy Point, the Brooks Range developments. Those are new units formed after January 1, 2003.
What about participating areas or expansions?
I'd have to ask DNR for the participating areas. I do not believe there's been an expansion that's been approved, but that actually goes through DNR, not Department of Revenue. They tell us what they've done to expand or make things out. This chart got a lot of work, and I've consolidated it during the legislative session. This is where we were looking at the fiscal impact of SB 21 compared to ACES. When we walked through this chart during the session, we pointed out that, and the way to read the chart is you start off with a provision of the legislation in various price levels. At the time, our forecast price for 2015 was $111.67 a barrel. This was based on the spring forecast and the work we did at the end of session. At $100 a barrel, the elimination of the progressive portion of the tax reduces state revenue by $750 million. At $120 a barrel, we told people it reduces revenue to the state by $2 billion. And what I've often seen is people stop the conversation at that one. Remember, SB 21, in addition to removing the progressive portion of the tax, also increased the tax from 25% to 35%. So at $100 a barrel, we told you that reduced state revenue $750 million by eliminating progressivity, but increased revenue $850 million by increasing the tax from 25% to 35%. The point was, when you walked through the fiscal impact of SB 21, there are provisions in the legislation, like adding credits based on production, that reduce revenue. There are provisions in the bill, like eliminating the capital credits and increasing the tax rate, that raise revenue to the state. Last year when we were discussing this, this was based on the assumptions in the spring forecast. We said at $100 a barrel, SB 21 would reduce state revenues compared to what you would get under ACES between $140 and $215 million a year. At 120, it would be between 740 and 815, and at our forecast price, we were looking at 430 to 505. Now, remember, the reason I use fiscal year 15 is it is the first full year of SB 21 being implemented. Fiscal year 14, the fiscal year we're finishing right now, SB 21 does not go into effect till January 1st. The Department of Revenue has revised our projections downward for fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 14. $1 billion in fiscal year 13 and roughly $2 billion in fiscal year 14. What I'd remind people of is Senate Bill 21 has not taken effect yet and will not take effect till January 1st. Those revisions to revenues that the department has put out, 75% of that time period are under the old tax system. There is one exception to that, and that was the closeout of the capital credits. Has an impact in FY14. That's about $200 to $300 million because companies earned those credits for spending in calendar year 13, and SB 21 made the decision not to roll that obligation forward to fiscal year 15, but to rather just close out the obligation that the state had created through the credit system on the North Slope. But I put on this that this is dated material because very important factors have changed from what we thought was going on in the spring to what the department sees today in the fall. And next, what I'd like to do is walk you through what those changes for fiscal year 14, fiscal year 15 are. Remember the four factors I told you about that affect how the tax rates work. First, we've got production, then we've got price, company spending, capital, operating, and then finally transportation costs, which are really the TAPS tariff. Many of these are related to each other. Firsthand, in the spring 2013, we said fiscal year 2015 would be 512,800 barrels a day. The decline has been faster than we thought it would be. Based on our actuals that we're seeing, 8.2% decline in fiscal year 13, we are projecting now 498,400 barrels a day. The decline, again, has been faster than we thought it would be.
Wait a minute, that's for what year? That's for 15?
Fiscal year 15. Yes. And what I'm comparing is what we were doing in the spring forecast, which this chart was based off of, the assumptions of price, production, tariff, and company spending, versus what we're seeing forecast in the actual FY15 performance of the tax system. We revised our ANS price expectations down from that $111.67 to $105.06. In the revenue source book is discussion that, frankly, at the time didn't even include Iran when we did our price forecast. We are seeing resolution of events around the world that are leading to more and more production, not just in the lower 48, but also geopolitically and globally. That led to the department revising down its price expectations.
And so if they dump another 4 billion barrels a day on the market in a year from now, this could look a lot worse than it is right now.
Very much so.
But better than it would be under ACES because the price will be lower.
Very much so. Yes. What we also saw that I think was expected, during the debate we talked about when are you going to see production turnaround, and we talked a lot about the first thing you see is investment. Investment is what comes before the production. Based on what we knew in the spring of our expectations of investment in capital spending on the North Slope, capital and operating was 6.294. We've seen a revised estimate up of roughly $1 billion in investment on the North Slope versus what we thought we saw in the spring. Also, remember, your transportation costs are ultimately the cost of taps, including your property taxes, divided by the amount of production. Less production, the transportation costs go up. So we revised our estimate of transportation costs up $1 to $10.03. What ultimately happens when you work all those things through the equation is the production tax value under ACES is reduced by $14.90 a barrel. What that does is make ACES a lower tax rate than you would get under SB 21. To show you how that works, what I've done is I've gone to page 106 of the fall revenue source book. The average production tax value, when you change all of these factors, drops the ACES tax rate, because the ACES tax rate depends on your production tax value. So the 35% tax rate in SB 21 is actually a higher tax rate than you would get with 25% plus. I'm going to walk through the math.
I'm not sure, but I think you swapped ACES for MAPS in your sample somewhere, and it kind of threw me.
You did say ACES is a lower tax.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
ACES.
That makes sense.
But earlier you were saying that, and this is what confused me, because you had said, Pete, also, and he agreed with you, that at the lower price, SB 21 is better than ACES.
Correct. For the Treasury.
Yes.
We pull in more money under SB 21 than we do under ACES at low prices.
But the previous chart shows that we're still losing money, and this says
what I did here, Representative Isaac, saying was take us back to the chart that we were using at the end of session and point out that it's dated material, because these factors that change really change this number, because it changes your understanding of what the progressive tax rate would deliver. So the $750 million and $2 billion number gets smaller. The credits for capital expenditures, because spending went up, actually get bigger. What we were telling you is based on assumptions around those four factors that between spring and fall have changed. We understand more about what's coming forward. Now, think about it. The projections that this was truly based on are largely the fall 2012, adjusted a little bit for spring 2013. A year later, we have a better understanding of the production coming next year, the cost coming next year, than we had really even a year ago. So what we were showing you at the time overstated the revenues that we would be getting under ACES under those assumptions. And now that the actual level of production the price has been reduced, the expenditures have increased, and the transportation costs have increased. At the time in the spring when we were debating this, we were overstating the revenues that would have been generated under ACES under the assumption that the timing comparison to SB20. Because of these factors that have changed, you're seeing the crossover point of where SB21 makes more money for the state actually rise up into about the 105 plus range, depending on the fiscal year.
Yes, I think the confusing part is that the MAB rate is higher and higher tax. It's, to me, it's funny to hear that the higher tax rate is better.
At lower prices.
I mean, I thought the goal was to have a lower, I mean,
well, also
you
predictability. You get rid
lower
of
taxes.
You get the predictability. The
right.
Benefits are it's got predictability and you don't have those crazy tax credits. But as far as the Treasury is concerned, when the argument is that ACES was good for the state because it put more money in the Treasury, well, that possibly you could say that at $120 per barrel, but except the production kept going down. But the point is at $105, it doesn't.
Yeah. Right. I think we're better protected. But I think if you think that the tax rate should be lower, it's odd to hear that this is better.
And to be fair, there were a lot of people arguing that were supporters of SB 21 for a lower tax rate than the 35%. That was a detailed discussion in the Senate Finance Committee, the House Resources Committee, the House Finance Committee. There was one point where the tax was reduced to 33%. That was pushed back up to 35% in the House Finance Committee with signals from many senators about their tolerance for a concurrence vote. That was going on at the time as people were balancing scenarios and looking at the impacts of progressivity across a range of prices and the impacts of different assumptions. The 35% tax rate in this situation with these assumptions actually, as Jeff said, creates a higher tax rate than under ACES. And what I was going to do next, so people can see it, was walk through the math based on the publicly available data in the RSP on page 100.
Can you go back just to 14? So the lease expenditures have gone up $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
What correlation does that have with increased production?
We have been very careful. This was a huge debate during the discussion around capital credits. Under ACES, the state was giving a credit based on capital spending, and there were lots of individuals, the administration included, that said, we have no direct correlation between a capital expenditure and increased production. And the argument against removing the capital credits was all spending leads to production.
That leads to production.
That was the argument to make at the time.
Mm-hmm.
What we see in the deductible lease expenditures that's different today is when you take it back to the publicly announced investments that are going on. I can't tell you confidential taxpayer information and what goes into these numbers. But if you look at the announcements, what you've seen is the addition, what's changed between last year and this year? BP has announced the addition of two new rigs drilling wells on the North Slope. ConocoPhillips.
But that has nothing to do with this because they tell us year after year after year that every time you change the tax structure, we can't tell you the effect on our internal plan is going to be for 5 years. So if we're going to build this new facility based upon what you're doing today, it'll be 5 years before our plant, we decide to do that. So everything that we're seeing this year was already on the books. Because you think government's slow. Those guys have a huge ponderance of process as well. I mean, to spend $1 billion is not just, let's do this now.
David, I'm not going to argue the fine details with you, but I don't remember them saying that over and over again. I mean, there may be some allusion to that, but I don't know if that's written in stone.
Well, I wasn't there last session, but all the previous sessions when we were discussing taxes, we would ask the question, well, what are we going to see next year? Well, you're not going to see anything next year. You're not going to see anything for 4 or 5 years.
Well, ACES is not a magic wand. Excuse me,
this tax thing, SB 21 is not a match one, don't get
me wrong.
But they were, that was under the environment of ACES 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, when we change from one thing to the next, it's been a consistent dialogue with them. They have a process that's cumbersome and takes a long time.
So, to be fair, last session, BP and Conoco both said, we will make the investment based on what you do with your tax structure. So they were already poised.
So historical context of tax structures and reinvestment and profits shows a very erratic picture. Just because they're making big profits, they're not turning the money back into production. That's part of my angst with them. It's like, okay, what's the reality of the situation? We don't know. They're making decisions on a worldwide level, not in Alaska.
Doesn't this go back to his chart earlier that showed all the other provinces increased their spending and they also increased their production?
No, because that's only in the States.
It's actually worldwide as well.
Worldwide,
yeah.
Right.
It's partly that, but I think actually the more important thing about the debate that happened last year is collectively the legislature and the administration turned away from that how much can we cut, actually what's broken and how do we fix it. And just from my perspective, that was a very different debate than the legislature and the governor around oil tax reform have had historically. It's what are the two fundamental issues in the tax system, how is the state protected, how is the system balanced, and how do we provide the ability for companies to plan and change their investment. And it wasn't based on what Senator Coghill said. He's right. It wasn't based at all on we're going to get this project or we're going to get that project. The department ran scenarios. The argument was, if you change your tax policy, companies will make decisions to invest. And my point is, we have seen a significant shift in investment, not just for this year, but to flip forward. Page 21. This is the change in our capital expenditure forecast. From spring 13, what we were projecting, to fall 2013. We see a slight increase in operating expenditure projections. We see a massive increase in capital expenditure projections over the next 10 years.
But it's tied to production. The capital expenditure.
One would hope. I mean, not all of that is.
To get the advantage of the credit.
Right.
That is the key.
That's the key to the whole thing.
Because now a company looks at the benefit they get on the credit side is based on the barrels of oil they produce. This was a huge part of the debate, is that there was a lot of good logic that went into ACES, that spending and investment's important. The problem was we were incentivizing spending, not incentivizing production, on the idea that by incentivizing one thing, it would lead to the other. What SB 21 did was flip that around and say, go to incentivizing exactly what you want. Directly incentivize production, and that leads to changes which we're seeing from companies talking about debottleneck and talking about facility constraints, moving into rigs and drilling. That's publicly what they're announcing that's different than what they were telling us last year. And there is what we're seeing is Conoco's already brought up a rig.
100 jobs.
Yep, BP has the RFPs to bring in rigs. The ability to get rigs up there and start drilling wells is something that can happen materially faster.
Now, Conoco delivered, didn't they?
They have one running right now.
I don't know when they move drill rigs from Seattle to here, but they've got another one for the next construction season. So that's 200 jobs. Tron Derrick said that was directly related to SB 21.
And Repsol too said really.
Just to be clear, Repsol is not in our production forecast in the way other companies are, just as Great Bear is not. And we'll get to that in a minute with production forecast, but those companies are still in the exploration stage. The Department of Revenue doesn't include something in our forecast until it's been discovered and it's at the place where a company is evaluating the opportunity.
And that's a change.
That part of it is not a change. Yeah. What the change was is a company comes in with plans and the Department of Revenue says, we're going to discount your plans because you're telling us an exact year, an exact production amount, and an exact spending. And we all know, Senator Bishop knows better than probably anybody, that projects don't happen when you think they are, at the level they think you're gonna, that you think they're gonna come in at, and at the cost. Building big projects just is complicated. They never work out exactly
the way you thought. I've been on jobs that were, that we were in the middle of construction, and they were canceled for increased production because some accountant in Denver decided that they needed the money someplace else.
That column didn't equal that column.
Yeah,
27.
And nothing to do. I mean, everything was ordered. We were for this.
Absolutely.
All right there.
Then you get a project like Liberty. It's a go.
And then it's no go. That's our point. In the production forecast, the department's change was to try and add a bit of discount.
But you were probably banking Liberty at
that time.
Yeah. And they spent $400 million in Liberty. Is still yet to produce one barrel of oil.
That's right.
David, I don't know if you are able to follow the debate on this, but they had a huge change in their forecasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah.
And I think what's important to remember is that this year, the department did not change that methodology 1 year to the next. And I'll talk through in a minute the impact.
So a lot of these numbers, so let me ask you, how far behind are we on audits now?
It depends on the audit. We do regular work on CapEx because CapEx is something that we give credits for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a regularly updated thing. There were changes to the TAPS tariff at the federal level and because of adjudication that actually made us reopen audits that were closed. Because remember, you change the tariff, I actually have to recalculate all of those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So things that happened have forced the department to reopen some of the audits.
Right, so never mind what needs to be reopened by court cases. Where are we at now? What year are they working on?
I will have to get, I don't do the operational side. I'll have to get that to you guys. So taking us back to the comparison of the tax systems, I did this from page 106, which is the income statements in the back of the revenue source book, so that the public and your staff can go through the math on a step-by-step basis and see the relationship here. There's two important caveats I'd encourage people to remember when they're using these income statements. First, they're based on average data. You will not get the same answer we get for general fund revenues in the source book. And the reason is when the Department of Revenue is doing the analysis, we're doing it based on confidential taxpayer information for each taxpayer and then rolling them up together. The numbers are close, but this is so the public can use our aggregated data to see what's going on in the comparison of the tax systems. So I've done that in the footnote to try and note out that it's illustrative. It's not meant to be an exact prediction, and you'll see the numbers move by $50 million here or there, depending on where we come up.
So all that's saying is all things being equal, the production tax value.
All things being equal.
Yeah.
So
I looked at that the first time, and I was having a hard time tracking it.
So we'll start off, as we do, with the ANS price. On the left column, I've got ACES. On the right column, I've got the MAPAC SB21. $105.06, $105.06. Same number for both tax systems. Transportation costs, new numbers, $10.03, $10.03. Lease expenditures, capital and operating. Remember, those are spending in Alaska for lease qualified expenditures. $45.99 per barrel. Gets us a production tax value under either system of $49.04 per barrel. You then multiply the production tax value by the amount of barrels being produced, taxable barrels, not royalty barrels. Under ACES, that gives you a $7.778 billion production tax value. The MAP Act gives you a lower production tax value. The reason is, remember, the MAP Act has a benefit for some of those units that were formed after January 1, 2003, that is a reduction in the production tax value.
So it's not clear on this one. Is it the next slide that you actually show the multiplier then?
That's right.
Okay.
And what I point out is, remember, we talked about the gross revenue exclusion in this chart as a reduction in revenue. So that's why you're seeing a different number here, and that's in page 106 shows you the impact of the gross value reduction at the time.
So on production tax value of $49.04, there's no progressive
There is. So now we go ACES versus MAPAC taking our production tax out. Remember, the ACES tax rate is the production tax value minus 30 times 0.4%, if the production tax value is under 92.50 a barrel. Above 92.50 a barrel, it goes to 0.1. But we're 49.04 minus 30 times 0.04 gives me a progressive tax rate of 7.6%. SB 21 does not have a progressive tax rate.
So that 0.04 is on $19.
Yeah. Yep. So your tax rate under ACES is 32.6%. The 25 plus the 7. Under SB 21, it's 35%.
We have no deductions yet.
No deductions yet. Well, we've deducted our capital and operating lease expenditures, which is the production tax. So now I've got my tax rate. Then I've got my production tax value, which, remember, is slightly different between the tax systems. You take your tax rate times your production tax value. This gets you your tax revenue before credits. Under ACES, 32.6% times $7.778 billion is $2.535 billion. Under SB 21, 35% of $7.715 billion is $2.7 billion. It's higher revenues.
And where did you get the PTV?
The PTV was calculated off of this page, taking my price minus my transportation costs minus my lease expenditures, gets me my production tax number. Production tax value times the taxable barrels gives you your production tax value on a total number.
Okay, this is where I'm lost on your chart.
Yep.
Is that since those are identical columns,
yes,
from that page itself,
yes,
the PTV should be the same, but you go to the next page, 16.
And what I did here was say new oil gets an additional reduction. I should have said additional to its production tax value. Under SB 21, I could do a better job of notation. You're right. This has about $63 million in benefit that's given to the new oil through the gross value reduction. That's why the production tax value is different. Otherwise, they'd be exactly the same.
That would be nice to...
Yep. I can do a little bit more detail in the annotation there. So you have your tax before credits, then you've got deductible credits. On the one hand, you have capital expenditure credits under ACES, and you have per barrel credits under SB 21. Now, it's important in SB 21 to remember the price has been reduced from our expectations. So it's not the $5 per barrel. We're into the $6 per barrel range. $6 per barrel times the taxable production gets me a subtraction of $960 million. Looking at 20%, for simplicity's sake, of the capital spending gets me $890 million in capital credits under ACES. Tax revenue under ACES then gets me 1.625. Under SB 21 gets 1.74. Remember, these are illustrative. It's so you can follow through the calculations. The numbers are not exact for what we get when we calculate company-specific information. When we calculate company-specific information, we see that SB 21 raises $50-plus million more than SB 20, than ACES at these investments, production, and price levels. As you go down in prices, Senator Kelly said, the number gets higher. As you go up in price, it gets lower. But really, the power is in the difference in the tax rates, 35% versus 32.6%. That fixed 35%, particularly as the numbers that are used to calculate the progressive tax rate change, SB 21 provides a significant amount of consistent balance protection to the state, which was one of the governor's principles in oil tax reform than what we looked at.
So when I'm unable to, I can't put in the deductions and all these pieces with a great deal of accuracy, but I can lay out the simple tax rate. And I can see that you start at 25% with ACES, and you go up 0.4% for every dollar increase in the barrel of oil.
In the production tax.
Over $30. You start at $30 and you climb up 0.4, 0.4, 0.4, and so
production tax value, yes.
We're now using both my math and my memory, the combination of which is not strong. So somewhere around $55 a barrel of PTV,
yes,
production tax value, would be the straight crossover with no credits.
That's
and
right.
No production pieces whatsoever. And so the differences in those credits then play even larger and bring that number down. In this case, we were at 40, what was the slide before, 49%? $49 a barrel? 46.
$45.99 per barrel in lease expenditures.
Yeah. So we have crossed over because of the difference, the greater deductions under ACES than under.
It's actually the crossover has more to do with the tax rate.
Getting to the tax rate has to give you your tax value, PPT. And you get to that PPT by how you come up with some of those deductions, the difference between.
It's always the problem in the circularity of the progressivity feature. So as you change a factor, you affect your production tax value, and your production tax value affects your tax rate.
Yeah.
And there's a circularity to the issue of the production tax value's relationship to the tax rate. That was the complexity, and that was the unpredictability.
So take us back to that first chart you were looking at.
This one? That's the circularity.
Yeah.
Is you're seeing highly variable tax rates based on those four variables. Those four variables actually come back and change your tax rate. The fundamental change that SB 21 did was fix the tax rate at 35%. Then the other one was link the credits, the primary credits in the system, directly to production. Those were the two major changes in SB 21 from ACES. Yes, sir.
Oh, I just referenced slide 10. I mean, I think that's, you know, I want to get them for all I can get, but still maintain a healthy economy. But if I was in business and you're trying to take a financial statement to the bank to get some money from, like me, to go mining and open up another, you know, 1,000 ounces I want to get here. Well, what's your tax rate? Well, I don't know. It's all over the map here on the price of gold. Well, hell, I'm not going to give you any more money. That's way too simple.
I was looking back at the original ACES bill because somebody asked us some questions on it the other day. One of the things that the original ACES bill that was introduced to the legislature did was move to an annual progressivity calculation. That was changed in the legislative process back to the monthly. So when Governor Palin brought the bill in, it was an annual. It ended up back as a monthly. That was one of the changes.
But it still would have been an after-the-fact annual. I mean, you would have had to do all of your production, and then you would figure out your tax after the fact based on what someone else set the price of oil.
Yep.
So you still couldn't do what Senator Bishop was saying, go to the bank and say, well, this portion of my financial plan includes taxes, because I don't know what that is. And since it's a rather substantial chunk of it, Mr. Roman, he would take a lot of it. Thank you. It's certainly a lead banker questioning or any some guy in Illinois doing your taxes.
Even if you got your own money and can float it, you'd have to question yourself. Anyway.
According to your price forecast?
Yeah.
Will SB 21 collect more money than ACES would have with the forecast of 105 next year, 107 the following year, then 110? I mean, when do you get into
I'm still working those through. I've had them run, I think, twice. We have a couple economists that took a break after the release of the RSB. I want them run 3 to 4 times before we release that 70 to 150, you know, over 10-year price comparison. What I've seen in the initials is that, remember, as production declines, the power of ACES, because you're dividing expenditures across, thank you so much, Mike, fewer and fewer barrels, your production tax value is getting lower. The crossovers actually increase materially in the out years. And it has a lot to do with what you think expenditures and production are going to be at that time. So it's not a simple straight line. It actually, SB 21 gets higher and higher as a crossover point over time, is what people are going to find because of the declining power. And we spent a lot of time in Senate Finance talking about this, looking at over time the power of progressivity was getting less and less. If you look going forward, as you have less production, more spending across fewer barrels, the tax rate was going to go down and down and down and down at prices that were reasonable. I mean, I found it very odd to call $105 a low oil price. We were looking at those problems 2 to 3 years ago in the Senate Finance Committee. I mean, these are not new issues that people have been kicking around. I think one of the other important pieces in SB 21 versus ACES is the differentiation. Because of the deductibility of what new development looks like versus what existing development looks like. Under ACES, from a policy perspective, we always thought it was flipped. Existing production by an incumbent producer, because of the deductibility and that buy-down effect on your tax rate, actually did better than a new developer coming in on their own. They paid higher taxes. We thought that was backwards. What you see in SB 21 from a competitive perspective is that it makes the new development more competitive than the existing legacy production.
That was global. Is North America part of that? Or is that a different graph?
Yeah, this was an excerpt that Barry Pulliam did after he left the department in a public presentation. You can go back to the PFC numbers and look at where these charts are. This was just we are, if I remember, the upper end of the middle globally. And then on new developments, we're actually down in the middle. So new development, especially as prices fall, the state will be much more competitive because we still retain a degree of a progressive tax system, whereas they're regressive, so they will actually go up in competitive or down in competitive as prices get lower, while we'll go up. The next two slides are really just, on the one hand, we had announcements that were coming out right after oil tax reform was passed. More recently, in June and as recently as December 3rd, we've seen these announcements, more meat put on the bones of what was said in early April. For example, BP in their press release does directly mention the evaluation of the expansion and demodelings of the existing Prudhoe Bay facility, because Senator Bishop said the incentives tied to production. Debottlenecking is very much in the interest when the incentives tied to production. The recent announcement by ConocoPhillips of an increase in their capital allocation to Alaska to $1.7 billion was their budget in 2012 was $600 million. Major, this reflects public statements that compare to what the department is forecasting of $10 billion in additional capital expenditures over the next 10 years. Finally,
that's just who's announced. Now, this is like a change again between spring.
Absolutely. Finally, I'd like to turn to our production forecast. First of all, I think it's really important to recognize what the production forecast is and what it is. The production forecast is not a holistic expectation of what the oil production will be on the North. It, as Representative Isaacson said earlier, does not include a lot of the explorers that are out there doing it. Both the Great Bears and the Russells, they're just not at a point where they've discovered something that can make it into our forecast. What the forecast really is the foundation for the revenue forecast. The revenue forecast is what the Department of Revenue is telling you to be able to expect going forward to make long-term decisions based on. In the past, I go back to the 2010 revenue source plan. Fall 2010, it predicted fiscal year 15 oil production would be 608,000 barrels a day in the North Slope. 3 years ago, we were telling you 608,000 barrels a day next year. It's going to be 498,000. That's what we're telling you this year. 110,000 barrels a day, roughly, that we didn't see. Part of that's Liberty. Part of that's NPRA. There are things in the production forecast that just didn't happen. So what the Department of Revenue did was a methodology that as you go out into future, increasingly discounts what we're understanding the future looks like. We're not saying that production's not going to happen. We're just saying, for the purposes of making a long-term financial plan for the state of Alaska, here is a more conservative way to look at the number. You're not banking on everything happening exactly when you thought it would.
Or the hand approach?
Being much more detailed. So,
go ahead.
Nope.
Your sentence.
I'm actually, it's good.
Okay. The upside potential portion there?
Yeah.
Is that considering your new way of forecasting, or is that upside potential like the old way of forecasting?
The upside potential is the old way of forecasting.
And then Governor
so
McCall?
So how reliable is that GVR eligible new oil?
The GVR eligible, we've got a high level of confidence. These three dark lines are what we're using our new forecast methodology. And we've got really the three buckets. We have, from the current wells and the current additions to those wells, then we see what we used to call like under development, under evaluation, really is the combination of not GVR eligible and GVR eligible. And what's going on there is people have asked the question, well, isn't all oil going to be new oil?
Isn't all oil
eventually going to be new oil under the tax system? I think the point we want to show is of those new projects that are additions we see, the vast majority of them are actually not eligible for the new oil provisions in SB 21. They are just subject to the sliding scale per barrel credit, just like legacy, because so much of the work is going on in the existing participating areas. The addition of two rigs of Prudhoe that are drilling into the existing participating area don't actually qualify as new oil under the tax system. New oil was a very targeted to specifics, and based on the public's request, we try and break that out over the next 10 years so people can see that it generally trends around 10% of production over time, because remember, those large legacy fields are the biggest productive base and the biggest resource base we have.
So you're saying if you do this chart in 2 years and these companies have fulfilled their advertisements and have brought up all these new rigs and have actually started drilling new oil wells, that these, especially the, the production is going to be much higher and that upside potential is going to be moved even greater because Great Bear and Repsol and those guys will be coming in.
Potentially. As we start to see
but
those
guys. The certainty will be a little bit more clear, and the level of production then will account for success of the tax
regime. The way the forecast methodology works now is next year when we come out with this forecast, everything here will have moved closer in time, which means we have a higher level of confidence in things that are next year or the year after that. Things 10 years out, we have a lower level.
Because what I was frustrated with the fall book is that even with 21 and the announcements, just as I was trying to decipher it, it just didn't seem to account for success. What if we succeed?
It didn't. And it didn't because
of your statement that we need to be as fiscally constrained as possible.
There's a big difference between what we expect for production versus what we're willing to bank on for calculating a revenue forecast. And given, in fairness, the degree to which the department has been wrong over time. I mean, go back to fall 2008 versus spring 2009. That was a $2 to $3 billion revision. That was all oil price driven. The department's projection in 2010 that you'd have 100,000 more barrels next year. A forecast, there are two types of forecasts. There's wrong and there's lucky. And the department is doing our best to try and revise our forecast to give you and the public a better methodology to make.
What I'm concerned about is that we don't create panic in our budget process and in the public's perception of where we are as a state by being too conservative, because in business, if you don't have revenue, you go out and get revenue. You just don't close the shop up because your projections are continually on the
hit. Well, the forecast was
chairman of the operating budget. I'm already
just so you know.
I know. Doesn't help you.
The forecasts over all the years will tell you that they're not very good at it. These are the best there are, and they're not very good at it. I'm not sure they're as good as the weatherman. And they'll tell you that.
Yeah.
There's good and lucky.
Yeah.
But to build on David's, I mean, to on the, in Doug's comments,
You know, I'll go back to 2004 under Governor Murkowski's administration. The 2004 fall forecast for year 2013, we were to be at 978,000 barrels a day. So my point is to maybe is good and lucky, but I think they are tightening it up to take a more analytical approach to the forecasting, and I think in maybe a couple of years, if their methodology is right, it'll take some of that fear away because they might be able to recalculate their forecasting in more real time, you know, because right now it's very tight, right? But as we see some of this, hopefully, production come on and their methodology is better, it needs time to work to summation, to put that confidence level back into the public, I think.
And I think it's important to go back to, you know, we've heard, you passed oil tax reform, where is the production? It's not in the revenue source book. It's not in the revenue source book because it hasn't been done yet, we can't count on it. But we definitely see the decline moderating and actually year-over-year increasing. There's a lot of potential we see out there, but for the purposes of the revenue forecast, we are not changing the methodology between what we walked through with the legislature last year.
Just on the side, since this is 90% of our revenue, going back to a comment Clickett mentioned earlier, you know, Tallarico and I calculated on the back of a napkin, if we just got 10% of our mining possibilities into production, we'd be making $18 billion on the current tax structure without any changes. So to me, that would be saying, let's not just fixate on oil, then let's diversify our revenue sources and expedite, get the mining production as fast as possible.
I have a group of, I have a couple people in the Department of Oil that would love some questions about money and the potential of additional mining to generate revenue. They are particular mining economists, and I think are tired of the emphasis being on oil. So they would be very excited to see some questions come from people about
so this
more mines come up, how much revenue comes from those under the existing system with no changes,
right.
How much more revenue would come from some mines.
I'd love to talk to them.
Yep.
And we should escalate that because this is...
Sounds like an invitation to me.
Yeah, this is discouraging to the max, and we cannot shut the state down just because we are so dependent on oil to the exclusion of every other resource that we have. We're in the top 10 of many resources globally, as Sullivan used to point out. We've got to do more than just oil.
And the policy implications are beyond what us at the Department of Revenue are going to talk about. That's really the Office of Management and Budget interacting with the finance committees in the legislature. I just want people to recognize that the methodology we're using is discounting what the expectations are out there. And frankly, if you step away from the production forecast and how we use it for revenue calculations and start to look at the production forecast as what are the opportunities out there based on the additional spending and work we're seeing, we do see a flat to increasing production base. Slight increases, but generally flat over time. Given an 8% decline last year, that is a material move. And what the companies were telling or making public statements about last year was 3 to 2% decline. Well, taking that 3 to 2% decline to 1 or 0 has very big long-term implications. We will see as the development actually happens what that looks like in the future. So we use this for a specific reason, and I really hope as you talk to your constituents, you can differentiate with them between a production forecast used for a revenue estimate and a production forecast used to see the future of what's going on in the field. They are two different things. But revenue, we are very conservative about it.
Mike, members can just come in, maybe hold questions until the end of your presentation because we're getting into
certain
time where people want to have to start taking.
Oh,
What's the effective tax rate of just new oil?
I have to go back and look. Is it 18%, 19%?
Because I remember studying some charts, you know,
It is down there for new oil, and it depends on the price, and it depends on your underlying production concerns.
Yeah. And so does that ever change? If it's new oil, is it going to be taxed at 18% or 19% as long, you know, forever?
And it depends on the price point.
Right.
Yeah.
So then how does that, if in the end game, when we're counting on new oil to increase our revenue share, you know, how is that going to affect the end and your projections on what's available?
It gets back to what is actually eligible for new oil is a big part of that. Increased recovery at Prudhoe Bay is not new oil. Additional recovery out of the existing fields at Caparic is not new oil. That's incentivized by the production-based credits and the tax system itself. So, you know, as we look at this, the tax rates were necessary to generate those new developments. The other thing, remember, the new developments, taxes are not the only way the state gets revenue from oil development. The royalty is still a very significant piece of the factor, especially in the new units. We saw the majority of them are 1/6, not 1/8 leases. So a lot of the new oil, you get royalty, there's corporate income tax, and there's property tax. So the state, through the production tax, making it a lower production tax on that new challenged infrastructure, jumpstarts it and gets revenues from the production tax, but also all the others. And that was part of our competitive comparison.
The rising tide floats all boats, though. You get more production, it decreases your NTP, your PTV on your transportation costs.
That's right.
Which now we're taxing the bigger piece of the pie.
That's right.
And when we say 18%, you're talking just production tax. You're talking the 12.5%
of oil. Yeah, I assumed you were talking, and you're also talking net, not a gross equivalent, because sometimes people like to see it gross so they compare it. Like Texas has a 4%. North Dakota, when you combine their two, is 11-something. I think that's going to change this next legislature for North Dakota. A lot of places are, you know, 3%. Just California is zero, frankly. It just depends on how you want to compare apples to apples. But net, effective net rate, I'd have to go
hold. Zero, but they have real high sales tax. Yeah. So their production tax is zero, but they have a high sales tax. So there is a tax on oil.
Yeah. That's just like we have a 9.4% corporate income tax, which is the fourth highest in the United States. Actually, I think it used to be. I think now it's dripped into sixth. There's a couple of states have increased their corporate income taxes.
And that's where the total government take was valuable.
Exactly.
But it's a bit of wand work to figure out what the total government take is.
That's right.
But if you've got total government taking 60% of your production, that implies that you have a maximum possible return of 40%, but oh, you cost you something. And I've always thought rate of return was a critical factor for my old mineral economics class. You sit down and you said, okay, I'm in the mining business, I should make 15%. Now, if I'm in oil, which is a much higher risk game, I thought it was 40%.
What we learned.
Maybe 30 at the most, but if you can't make 30% net total off the top of everything you've spent, then you shouldn't be in the business and you're not going to get financed.
What we learned that I think is really important is don't focus on any one metric. Look at all of them in the relationship to each other. I think one of the best examples of that is Norway. When you look at Norway on a government take basis, on an internal rate of return basis, on an NPV basis, you look at Norway and say, why would I ever invest in Norway? None of those really look that good. But then you look at Norway's cash margins. And because of their system and the way it works, the cash generation in the first 5 years of a field's life in Norway are massive. Because essentially the government really doesn't take anything in the first several years of the field. That makes the investment really work for a company. So if you go back to the Econ 1 slides that we had that measured across the board and across the jurisdictions, you'll start to see how these different metrics become important. You need to look at all of them together, not just one specific factor. Canada oil sands, it's the base of production that those provide. Those are factory operations that are amazingly long-term.
Does that put new production always in the forefront then in Norway? they're giving it the first 5 years? I mean...
No, you don't shut in. I mean, when Norway, one of the things Norway is going through right now was similar to what we looked at, which is we just actually had the Norwegian Petroleum Directorate over a couple weeks ago, the impact of cost overruns on their tax system. Because of the way their net and uplifts work, they were seeing similar problems that the state was, which was through the capital credits and the deductibility, you kind of get a double benefit for that spending,
right,
which when you have cost overruns has a huge impact on the Treasury. And that was because of a couple of different rigs in the offshore in Norway that created some real big fiscal impacts on Norway.
And I think some of that reflects what Joe was trying to say. And do you have scenarios where you net back to a zero PBT production tax by wellhead?
That's right.
Because what problem I can do when you ever get to a point where you make money on it.
Question. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Happy to come up.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, it was your dad. That's who I thought it was.
Then
Mr. Pulowski.
Yeah.
Have you mentioned this report?
No, I haven't.
It talks about Alaska. It was in November. But what I find intriguing in here, they have some tax policy.
Yeah.
And if you take MAPA
and run it through,
through